call our next case, which is case number 76052, Kenneth Bronk et al. Versus 8th Judicial District Court. Daniel Wolf is real party in interest. We have Ms. Solid representing the petitioners, Mr. Christensen representing the real party in interest. Hey, counsel, you wish to proceed? Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I would, Your Honor. 3 minutes, please.
You may do so. Okay, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Holly Solid of Holland and Hart. We're here today on a writ of petition seeking an order that the District Court dismiss the Second Amendment complaint below. A writ is needed here because the District Court exercised subject matter jurisdiction over derivative claims when there is none. The corporation in question here is a British Columbian Canadian corporation, and under its statutory authority, derivative claims can only be brought in the Supreme Court of British Columbia.
Did Midway do any business in Nevada? Any gold mines here? Or what?
There is a gold mine in Nevada, okay. Your Honor, but I will submit and
I understand your argument, a derivative of the case must be brought in the province of British Columbia and their courts there. Like that.
And the argument that we're making is under the internal affairs doctrine, it is the law of incorporation of the company which governs the relationship between the corporation, its shareholders, its creditors, especially when you are suing directors and officers for liability.
Ms. Holland, I wonder if you could address a preliminary issue. My understanding is that there are personal jurisdiction motions that have been stayed in the court below. Why should we consider this writ here before that's been resolved? If there's no personal jurisdiction, the case should be dismissed on those grounds.
Well,
aren't we venturing out on an advisory order or opinion by addressing the merits of your writ at this point?
I would disagree, Your Honor.
What causes us to get there? Could you?
Okay. I will tell you why we get there. There were three rulings that were provided by the court. One was dismissing the state securities law claim under California statute. The second one was allowing all the common law claims to go forward, presumably under California law, although we don't know which law was applied by the district court. And yes, there was a ruling that limited discovery could be taken on personal jurisdiction. The personal jurisdiction basis goes away if the court addresses the writ here, because the writ addresses the only two remaining issues, which are whether the breach of fiduciary duty and aiding and abetting claims are derivative and should have been dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction,
so
which can't cure.
I have a related question to this. Mm-hmm. It seemed like one reason this court would entertain your writ is because isn't there one defendant who is a Nevada defendant?
Right,
and so the personal jurisdiction litigation that's taking place in the district court wouldn't apply to him or her.
No, and in fact, the case would remain.
At least insofar as your writ is concerned, our resolution of that writ would resolve that legal question as to that defendant.
That's correct, Your
Honor. Is that a fair assumption of this?
That is correct. And okay. If the court were to grant the writ and agree that there was no subject matter jurisdiction over breach of fiduciary duty claims in this case, those claims go away.
Who is that defendant?
Mr. Yu.
Okay, thanks. I'm sorry for using your time up there. I apologize.
Okay. And if the court were to grant on the second grounds, which relate to the plaintiff's fraud and negligent misrepresentation claims, which are being brought as holder claims, then the rest of the case is gone. There is no remaining case. And then it also cannot be refiled somewhere else. So a dismissal on those grounds is obviously preferable for the plaintiffs.
Would you address the Citigroup case as it relates to the fraud and negligent misrepresentation claims, or how you would distinguish it, if at all?
Yes, I will. The Citigroup case was only involved fraud and negligent misrepresentation claims, number one. There were no breach of fiduciary duty claims alleged in that case. Stepping back, if we go to the direct harm test that has been endorsed by this court following Tooley, the Citigroup court struggled with the issue. If this was a breach of fiduciary duty claim, and if this plaintiff was arguing that a duty owed to him or the shareholders or the corporation was breached, then this does not apply. The Citigroup case was a very limited slice in time. The Delaware court, Chancellor Strine, struggled with the fact that he was finding that a holder claim was a direct claim, and very, very painfully said, if the plaintiff had not said over and over and over again, I do not have a breach of fiduciary duty claim, the result would have been different. The other issue there is that it was a certified question that was sent from the Southern District of New York to the Delaware court. And if you read the opinion and if you read the dissent, Justice Strine struggled mightily on that. I would also say that cases following...
They didn't seem convinced there should be a holder claim, but that's not before us today.
Correct. And that's the other difference about Citigroup. The Delaware court had to assume there was a holder claim. That was the question posed to them. It was not whether or not to find that a holder claim existed under Delaware law, which Delaware has never found, nor has British Columbia, by the way, and nor has this court. But the district court and Citigroup was forced to assume that Florida law or New York law, which recognized holder claims in certain circumstances, was the law that they were looking at.
Well, but given that they're asserting claims for fraud and negligent misrepresentation, apparently under California law, and what the court said in Citigroup is those kinds of holder claims don't belong to the corporation. They don't seem to be, so they wouldn't be derivative. Right?
If you look at cases, however, which apply Tooley and where there are breach of fiduciary duty claims involved, I would say that Citigroup doesn't apply. You don't do the analysis in that way. The analysis is first, are the claims direct or derivative under Tooley? Not does the court, I mean, we have to step back and say, whose law is being applied here? And that is something that I do want to address very carefully, because I think without going through the internal affairs doctrine and the conflict of laws of Restatement 309, you can't get to where we have to get on this case because it's just different. But I would say that even the California courts have, federal district courts in California following Citigroup have said applying California law, which recognizes a holder claim, that when you look at the entire balance of the complaint, you have to look at not what the plaintiff says, but what's in the allegations. The conclusion is breach of fiduciary duty, you have to look what the harm is, you have to look who suffered, but you can't just say, I got hurt, I get the money, so it's a direct claim. What you have to show is whose duty was breached. This court has recognized in parametric that generally directors and officers owe a fiduciary duty to the corporation, not to shareholders. There are exceptions when you're dealing with a minority-majority controlled situation. The duty owed by the directors and officers of Midway Gold was to the corporation. Those claims were only
the point of the test to determine whether the particular fiduciary duty claim asserted is one as to the corporation or to the individual shareholder.
Correct. And I submit that if the district court below had done the analysis again, as it had been done the first time on the first amended complaint, under the first amended complaint, the district court dismissed the entire case because it was derivative. There was no standing. No subject matter jurisdiction. The court had no power to hear the case. When the plaintiff repled in the second amended complaint, nothing changed in terms of what he was arguing about. He was arguing about omissions and disclosures by a publicly traded corporation with shareholders all over the world and saying that he bought stock, actually shares, and then held his stock while the price went down and the company went into bankruptcy. I would submit that all of the defendants named in this case held stock. They all were left. Every shareholder of Midway was left holding stock at the day that Midway went into bankruptcy. That doesn't give them a claim in this situation.
Did Mr. Wolfus exercise any of his stock options before the price decline?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did Mr. Wolfus, excuse me, I'll rephrase the question, did Mr. Wolfus exercise any stock options after leaving the company and while the price was declining?
He only exercised stock options after he left the company. Before he left the company, he made lots of trades.
Mm-hmm.
These stock options were granted in 2009 pursuant to an employee stock option plan. They had a 5-year vesting. So he sold them in this case exercised them in 2014 as they were about to expire at half the price of what the market price was.
So my question is, does the fact that he's exercising stock options create a direct harm for Mr. Wolfus that isn't present with respect to other shareholders who'd have a derivative claim?
No.
Why not?
Because as the district court held below, the point in time that matters when you're judging an exercise of stock is when the stock is granted, because the price at which it's sold is set at that time. When they expired in 2014 for 50 cents when the stock was selling for a dollar, that is not a direct claim. Because the claim is that the purchase or sale took place in 2009. There were no representations made, omissions made while he was still at the company. And I would submit that plaintiff recognized this problem with his complaint, because one of the things he changed when he came back with the second amended complaint is he no longer stated that he exercised stock options. All of a sudden it now just says I purchased shares.
So that distinction that I've asked you about is no longer present in the second amended complaint. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
It's the same event. Mm-hmm. It's just not accurately stated of what the event was. Mm-hmm. It was an exercise of the right to buy at below market prices. So, the next step is there's absolutely no claim that could be provided in that situation because there's no purchase or sale, which is the same reason the statutory claim under the California law was dismissed. So he tries two things. He tries to say, I have a purchase or sale, and that's the stock option exercise. Those claims were thrown out. He only has holder claims left. The district court addressed that. So we're only talking about a holder claim.
Okay, did you want to reserve the
balance? I did, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Christensen.
Good morning. Dan Wolfus sued Midway because of Midway's lies. Dan Wolfus bought stock from Midway because of Midway's lies.
Did he sue Midway?
No, he did not. But
right.
For Midway's bankruptcy,
right.
Midway would be a primary defendant in this case. In January and September of 2014, Dan Wolfus bought stock in reliance on Midway's lies concerning its condition.
He exercised his options, correct?
Yes, that's how he bought the stock. The distinction that was tried to be drawn here and its impact upon the causes of action was not attempted in the court below, was not intended in the briefing. But even so, for that kind of surprise argument, it has no merit. The court dismissed the first cause of action. The court did not dismiss the fourth and the fifth causes of action. The fifth cause of action is for California common law fraud based on the purchase of shares in January and September of 2014. So that claim remains. This is not just a holding claim. This is a purchase and a holding claim. When Mr. Wolf has bought stock from Midway, he was in California, a California resident, based upon representations made by Midway that he received in California, and he acted in reliance on California. Under choice of law principles, that means California law applies.
Now, why did you file this suit in Nevada, though, versus California?
We have to find a defendant. We knew Frank Yu lived in Nevada. We knew that Midway had a huge on-the-ground presence in Nevada. All of their mine claims, except for one or two in Washington, are located in Nevada. Their primary mine, the Pan Mine, is in Nevada. They have...
In White Pine County.
Correct. Yes. They have upwards of a dozen subsidiaries, all Nevada LLCs or LL company, or Nevada companies. They have a really big footprint in Nevada. All of the officers and directors, or at least I should say the overwhelming majority at the Discovery, have at one time or another been to Nevada on company business. Some of that business, we have asserted, is based for the reference on the Disclosure Committee and the other committees that control, write, and enter into the public disclosures that were sent to Mr. Wolfus in California. So we chose Nevada.
They weren't specifically sent to him, were they? They're just the public statements and securities filings and press releases.
Correct.
Okay.
And there is no distinction under a stock claim for common law fraud between I send it directly to you or I'm sending it out to the world through, say, the Edgar system on the run by the SEC. You can't get away with it. There is a remedy for making a false statement in an SEC disclosure.
Of course. And so if the corporation misrepresented what its status was in public statements, then understanding it's now in bankruptcy, it would be responsible for those misrepresentations. And then potentially there would be a derivative claim back against the individual directors for their breach of fiduciary duty in causing the corporation to make those misstatements.
That's drilling down to whether or not this is a mismanagement case. And it's not from the plaintiff's point of view. I understand the company is, or the company officer and directors is trying to frame it that way. But this is not a mismanagement case. This is a case where Mr. Wolf has received representations and then made specific acts based upon those lies.
How is that any different than every shareholder that was a shareholder of the company? I'm trying to understand, and I think it's critical under Parametric that you articulate what is the direct harm. I thought in Parametric we made our very best effort to demonstrate that there is a distinction and that the direct harm allows the shareholder to go forward if it's a direct harm. What is the direct harm to Mr. Wolfus that is distinguished from the claim that any other shareholder would be making? And I'd like you to refer specifically to the allegations in the second amended complaint that demonstrate the existence of that direct harm.
I will. The fifth cause of action, for example, for common law fraud, which is recognized in California, is for the purchase of the shares by Mr. Wolfus based upon the lies of Midway. The problem we run into is the framing of the issue is one of stock price. And as the Delaware court observed in Tooley, that is incorrect and inaccurate and leads to false results. What happened in this case, and remember the distinction is fairly basic and was laid down by Chief Justice Traynor, by the California Supreme Court back in 1969 in Jones versus Amundsen. A direct claim is brought for harm done to the plaintiff. A derivative claim is brought for harm done to the company. That doesn't necessarily have anything to do with stock price. In our case, a direct claim is one that belongs to Dan Wolfus. A derivative claim is one that belongs to Midway. What happened in this case was Midway lied to Dan Wolfus, reached out to Dan Wolfus, took his money, put it into their pocket, and handed him stock. And that relationship happened because of misrepresentations. Now what happens is Mr. Wolfus is asking for the money back. That has nothing to do with any other stockholder. And that's why Tooley warned against using stock price as some sort of a metric or guidepost for determination of these types of claims. Another way to look at it is To paraphrase Citigroup and to paraphrase Mr. Kleinberger, whose work was cited in Parametric, this claim or the claims brought by Ms. Wolfis, for example, in the fourth and fifth cause of action are direct because they could not plausibly belong to Midway. Midway has the money in its pocket. Midway can't sue to get the money back. It already has it. It would have to sue itself. There is no plausible argument that Mr. Wolfis is suing on a claim that actually belongs to Midway. That it's a fraud claim, it's particular to the person defrauded.
Well, doesn't your client effectively have a claim against Midway, albeit in the bankruptcy, and then assuming you're successful in that claim, then Midway has a claim back against its officers and directors?
Whether Midway has a claim against officers and directors and whether they have to exercise it is not a part of the examination of whether Mr. Wolfis has a direct claim. And here's the issue, and bankruptcy is kind of a gorilla in the room that we really haven't talked about. Under California law, while Midway is the primary defendant, all of these officers and directors in the claims brought by Mr. Wolfis in the second amended complaint are secondarily liable. And our second amended complaint is extremely detailed. Maybe it was a little bit overplayed, but we actually included the cases and the rationale on how those claims exist in California law, why they belong to Mr. Wolfis, and why they're direct. And it has nothing to do with the fact of stock price. Stock price eventually comes in at the end of the day when you're discussing damages. But to paraphrase Tooley, it is incorrect and inaccurate to use stock price as the sole or as even as any metric of whether a claim is direct or derivative. As you said in Citigroup, Citigroup basically reached back in time to Chief Justice Traynor and said, your basic analysis is whose claim is it? In this case, Mr. Wolfis is suing to get that money back out of Midway's pocket. And he's going after the officers and directors because they are secondarily liable under California law. And California law does apply. 309 does not. Taking a quick look at comment A of 309, it talks about this 309 being applied to a plaintiff class action. And then if you go on, it talks about how individual claims are not addressed by 309. This is a fraud claim, which under General Motors, since we've adopted the second restatement, you go to 145 for tort, and then you go on down the list, and section 148 talks about choice of law for fraud and misrepresentation claims. And 148, of course, refers back to section 6, as most of them do. And if you look at all of those factors, where Mr. Wolfis was when he purchased the stock, the place of reliance, the place where he received the lies and omissions. If you take a look at the compelling state interest of California in ensuring a fair and fraud-free business climate, if you look at the compelling state interest of California, the fifth largest economy on our planet, in ensuring that equity sales within its border match its stock rules and stock laws, the answer is clear that California law applies. There's an interesting issue because the court below and the parties below, we all addressed the direct versus derivative question. Basically, we went first to Parametric and then we argued the surrounding cases. I'm not sure if that was appropriate or not. Maybe there should have been a choice of law analysis that preceded that, but I don't think it matters because if you look at California choice of law rules, if you use choice of law and you apply California law on whether this was direct or derivative, you come to the same answer. It's direct because this claim couldn't possibly belong to the company. This is Mr. Wolfis's claim. If the company has a claim later on for contribution or indemnity or whatever, that doesn't have any impact on what Dan Wolfis is suing for. Any recovery from this suit is going to go to Dan. It's not going to go to the stockholders as a whole. It's not going to be divvied out a dollar to each holder of stock or whatever. It's going to go back to Dan. He's going to get that money back out of Midway's pocket. I would like to talk just very briefly about the holder claim. Petitioners framed the issue incorrectly. The general law is that the law has always recognized a claim in tort for fraudulently inducing inaction or forbearance. Always. Really, what the petitioners are saying is we want an exception to that general rule. We want to be protected from the general rule because for some reason, in the area of stock, the general rule should not apply. So it's not a question of Nevada recognizing a holder claim. It's really a question of, does Nevada want to recognize an exception to the general rule to immunize companies that make false statements and induce others to hold stock?
Does Nevada law even apply to whether there's a holder claim or not?
No. California law does. If you go through the choice of law analysis, 309 does not apply. You're going to go to 145, which throws you to 148. And when you combine 148 and 6, all the compelling state interests, the significant relationships, they all come up California. California recognizes holder claims. In fact, the court in Small versus Fritz, the Supreme Court of California, framed the issue correctly. It said, we recognize the general rule is, if you induce someone into inaction, that's a claim, and we decline to carve out an exception for you folks who are inducing folks into inaction on the selling of stock. We don't see a public policy behind that, and it went through the policy rationales. And remember, that decision was in 2002, and they actually referred to congressional record findings concerning the Enron scandal, for example, and it found compelling state interests in curbing that type of conduct. And it went on to say, look, and this is true in this case, if there becomes a proof problem on down the road, that can be addressed through a Rule 56 motion or some other type of claim.
Any questions? Mr. Christensen. Any questions? Okay, Ms. Sollett.
I would like to go back to my discussion of the internal affairs doctrine. If this court does anything, it must find the California law cannot apply here because that is completely erroneous. The Restatement of Conflicts 309 is what applies, and I'll start from the beginning. The U.S. Supreme Court recognized that the corporation's internal affairs have to be governed by the law of incorporation. Nevada recognizes this. California, which has not been brought up by my opponent, has codified the internal affairs doctrine and basically says we recognize it except where a company is not publicly traded and two-thirds of the outstanding shares are owned by California residents. California has dealt with the issue of whether or not their law applies. Every single case that Mr. Wolfis has cited in his pleadings from day one, Lazar, I'll go through all of them. Every single case that he has used, Apollo, American Lease, no publicly traded corporation was involved. They were private entities. They were bridge loans. They were limited partnerships. Not a single publicly traded corporation was at issue in any of those cases. This is not a new argument. This was raised in our reply brief on the
on the petition. It was raised below. I also want to say that there's a reason all federal courts, all state courts recognize this, because when you have a publicly traded corporation with citizens all over the country, you can't have one state's law apply. The law of incorporation applies. Mr. Wolfis was the CEO and chairman of the board of this company, a Canadian company. He purchased stock in a Canadian company. British Columbia does not recognize a holder claim. It follows Delaware law very closely, and it follows the same rules that we have set here in Thule and in Parametric. So there's a basic reason why all of this is smoke and mirrors. None of those cases dealt with a publicly traded company, and California law has no bearing on a case against a Canadian company whose principal place of business was in Colorado. The only relationship to California in this case is Mr. Wolfis. But I assume when he was chairman and CEO of this company, he was living in Colorado. There is no basis for allowing these claims to go forward under California law. Either Nevada law or the law of British Columbia, which is the same in terms of not allowing holder claims, requiring a purchase or sale, and how you describe derivative versus direct claims, they're all the same. It doesn't require an analysis unless the court has to choose between California and one of those other jurisdictions.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you both. You're excellent.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Justice Barrett.
Could you just address his point that this is a direct claim because it's very unique to Mr. Wolfis, and that Midway doesn't have the same type of claim?
Well, I would say that Midway is in bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Bankruptcy court has its Chapter 11. A claim was never filed by Mr. Wolfis in the bankruptcy court for either direct or non-direct. I don't understand why he is different than every other shareholder or employee who exercised stock options at the time, or the people he has sued. This is an irony that the man who was the CEO and acquired all this stock at below market prices is now suing his colleagues, saying that once he left, he didn't have that inside information that he could then know what was going on, and so he held his stock. I submit that it is a holder claim. The holder claim should not be recognized under any law, because we can't recognize California law. You know, only 8 states recognize holder claims in the entire country. 15 of them have outright rejected them because they're too speculative. How does anyone could say, once the stock goes down, I would have sold had I known. And he says he read all the press releases, and that's when he would have sold. So they're inherently subject to hindsight, making up a claim later. And it is very unfair, in particular, when you have an issuer that is in bankruptcy, because it's meant to evade the creditor process. If there was a real claim here, it should have been brought in the bankruptcy court, and it could have been dealt with there. The trustee in liquidation pursued no claims against these defendants. So this is an end run around every rule of securities law that I've known for 30 years. And I would ask that the court grant our petition. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we will take this case under submission. Thank you both for your excellent arguments and briefs. And we'll be in recess for the next call.